Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the rest of Africa this Thursday, February 13, 2025. A lawmaker from Western Equatorial State is calling on the national government to protect civilians from attacks.
The people shooting on the civilians are our own forces, the South Sudan People Defense Force, SSPDF, under the command of the Division 6 commander based in Maridi. They are the ones shooting.
And the international community is celebrating World Radio Day.
But the way radio is right now is not the way radio was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. I'm talking about the infrastructure. But them days, presenters or even disco jockeys used to work with record players or reel-to-reel tapes. Nowadays, things have changed.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A lawmaker representing Tambura County in Western Equatorial State says the national government should protect families displaced by armed men who have been on rampage in the area. Jacqueline Matthew Gaza says many of the residents of Tambura Town affected by insecurity need support.
As far as Tambura County is concerned, to give you the most recent, between date 8th of February, till today, the situation has not changed. The military deployment along Tambura and Bo Road still remains the same. The shooting taking place on the civilians, burning of their houses and looting of their properties, and the civilians running in the bushes all over is still the same.
Who is shooting the civilians and taking their properties? I mean, somebody has to be held accountable for that. Who is doing that?
The people shooting on the civilians are our own forces, the South Sudan People Defense Force, SSPDF, under the command of the Division 6 commander based in Maridi. They are the ones shooting.
Have you complained to the headquarters in Juba or the military, you know, headquarters in Juba about what is happening in Tambura?
Since this situation began, because it keeps on graduating from one level to another, It began when the forces were deployed to contain the security situation that was in Tambura to protect the people and maintain peace. But the next thing we saw was that the forces moved, instead of being in Tambura, some of them moved to Bo in Najero County. And there we started hearing about a counterattack with the SPLM-IO forces, because they moved directly to the area that is under the control of the SPLM-IO forces. And then the few that remained in Tambura continued shooting on the civilians, scaring them and making them to run all over the bushes as their properties have been looted. Then the worst part now began on the 8th and 9th, when these forces left Bo, Najero, coming back towards Tambura. And along the road, they actually did a lot of atrocities where almost all the houses along the roads have been burnt down. The medical facilities broken in and all the medicines taken, the shops, everything. And when they find anyone on the road that they can kill, they kill.
Lawmakers from Tambura County, I mean, I am familiar with Western Equatorial State. Lawmakers from Tambura County, I will, you know, mention them by names. Yourself, Clement Mbogoniweah, Pascual Bandindi, the Speaker of the National Legislative Assembly, Nunu Kumba, and the former governor, Joseph Pakasoro. All of you are silent when Tambura is on fire. Why is that so?
First, to speak on my own behalf, I have not been silent. I have been releasing some press to call for calm and call for intervention for the suffering of the people, and to call on ceasefire to stop whatever is going on there through press. But then that is at the individual level. But at the general level, for all of us as leaders, to tell you the truth, we have never come together as leaders on as far as the issue of Tambura is concerned. there could be different reasons. Maybe some of them fear maybe element of arrest by the security because this situation is worsening day and day. But some of them just might not have the will to do so.
When President Kiir removed Governor Alfred Futuyo, there was celebrations in Yambio, in Ezo, in Tombora. Why should certain counties be dancing when political appointees are removed?
The issue of the removal is in connection with the already existing problem dated back when the state itself, when it was given to the SPLM-IO party. That decision was not welcomed by some of the communities within Western Equatoria, which is why you see that, just like you said, out of the 10 counties within Western Equatoria, only 3 counties were celebrating. That is part of Tombora and Ezo and Yambio. But the other 7 counties within the state have not been participating. It is rather more connected to the party line and the tribal line, because he comes from a minority tribe, that's a Balanda tribe, and it has never happened in Western Equatoria where any other tribe has ruled as a governor. And he was resisted right from the time he was appointed not to lead. So all of that, it kept going on and graduating throughout the years, for the last 4 years, till the past few days when he was removed.
But help me understand, is there anything in the constitution that whoever wants to become a governor in Western Equatoria must come from a certain tribe?
There is nothing as such in the constitution that a particular tribe has to.
And then why is it that when someone from a different community is appointed, some other people will resist?
I think this comes from probably the different beliefs and the feelings of superiority that happens in different communities, where one community think they're superior than the other. I could say that. It so happened that when another community is considered to be minority, it seems somehow in their beliefs they are not supposed to lead, but which is contrary to what our Bill of Rights tells us in our constitution.
Well, Honorable Jacqueline, last question here. With all this happening in Western Equatoria State, what are the leaders doing to bring an end to this crisis in Tombora? I'm talking about traditional leaders. I'm talking about political leaders. I'm talking about opinion leaders. What are they doing to bring an end to this problem?
What I will say is that the community leaders at this juncture has no direct connection to the presidency or to the top leadership here to express or air out their grievances directly, such that their cry is being heard. Despite of recent, some of them made efforts to come and meet the president, but it did not work out. That is as far as they are concerned. But for the political leaders, it is very complex. I could relate it to the political will, because if the political will is not there, there's nowhere a country that has respect for human rights will allow civilians go through such kind of a torture that is happening now. Bodies are rotting in the bushes, and children and women are all over the bushes with no access to medical, with no access to shelter, because most of their houses have been burned and all of that. So to me, I would relate it all to the political will. But looking at it closely, this is a provocation that can even lead to the risk of the collapse of the RRCs.
Talk to me about the way where the governor is. It's my understanding that when the decree was issued on the national broadcaster, that's the South Sudan Broadcasting Corporation, the governor took to the bush. Where is he?
I do not know where the governor is, to tell the truth. Since all that happened, I think the person who can tell us best who the governor is the Division 6 commander of SSPDF himself, because according to information, he was right there in defense of the state house the day the decree happened and the shooting began inside the state house. So only him can tell us better where the governor is. But I do not know really where the governor is at the moment. As long as I've not seen in the news that he's anywhere else, which means he's nowhere else, we don't know.
That's Jacqueline Matthew Gaza, a member of the National Parliament representing Tombora County in the National Legislative Assembly. She spoke with me from Juba earlier today via WhatsApp. a facility supporting vulnerable children in Juba say it is facing challenges after U.S. President Donald Trump suspended some U.S.-funded programs across the world. An orphanage in the capital says it depends on individual South Sudanese employed by international nonprofits for support. For VOA News, Charles K. Mack reports from Juba.
The staff at an orphanage in South Sudan's capital, Juba, say some local donors have stopped making personal contributions for its operations after the United States put a 90-day pause on funding from the U.S. Agency for International Development. Reverend Martin Ojok, director of Atekiluak Orphanage, says he gets his support from individual South Sudanese who work for USAID-funded projects in South Sudan. He says he does not know what to do with the more than 250 children the orphanage cares for.
Like we now, we are confused now because the USAID, they are supporting us, and the embassy, the people who are working, the embassy of the American embassy, they are the ones who are supporting this orphanage. But now, President Trump stopped the America to support.
Joseph Ujio Mamur, a head teacher at the orphanage, also says South Sudanese donors working for some USAID-funded programs stopped helping the institution.
Yeah, indeed, the USA has been helping us so much, mostly in terms of its collective materials, giving these children books, pens, and not only that, they even help us. They gave us some containers to store things and accommodate with the children. They were even giving more help for us. But since we had the news, it really shocked us because we know that it will affect us much. They were the best people who normally do helping us here. Whenever we raise any concern, sometimes in terms of food even, they do helping us.
As a nutritionist at a World Vision USAID-funded project, he says he will not be able to support the orphanages after his contract was suspended last week.
Italy, it became hard for me and my colleagues to have our routine done after when all the USAID-funded projects were suspended. So all our contracts also came to an end. And that one gave us hard time. We are unable to really give the support that we used to do. I am a nutritionist. I work for World Vision as a nutrition nurse. But as for now, because there's no funding, it's really hard for us to give the support that we could.
President Trump's executive order suspends all U.S.-funded aid programs for 90 days while his administration reviews them to make sure they meet U.S. national interests. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has issued waivers to the polls for some programs that meet urgent humanitarian and health needs. For VOA News, I am Charles Kema, reporting from Juba.
Public universities in Malawi have ordered all students sponsored by USAID to drop out or seek other sources of funding if they want to remain in school. This follows the 90-day freeze on U.S. foreign assistance recently announced by President Donald Trump. Malawi's government is attempting to ensure that students continue their education, but universities have warned they cannot support the students on their own. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The U.S. government, through its development arm, USAID, has long provided financial support to thousands of students in Malawi's public universities. Now the aid freeze is affecting several universities, including the Lilongwe University of Agriculture and Natural Resources, Nzuzu University, Kamuzu University of Health Sciences, and the Malawi University of Science and Technology, or MAST. James Mpande is the communications manager at MAST. He says the U.S. foreign aid freeze is a big blow to several USAID-funded projects the school was implementing.
And what it means now is that everything has been suspended. So if we are developing a curriculum, we can't proceed. If we had some outreach activities, we can't proceed. If we are in the process of making some procurements, we can't proceed.
He says some sponsored students may face the impact next semester.
Fortunately, we are in the mid of a semester, so probably fees or support for this semester was already sorted out. But for the upcoming semesters and years, it means the students will have to look elsewhere for support or they risk withdrawing.
However, Patience Yamikani Chakwana, a beneficiary of USAID at MUST, told VOA that she's already feeling the impact. Chakwana, a first-year student in business information technology, says the foreign aid suspension was imposed before students received money for their daily upkeep.
It was really unexpected. We just like started school, like after a week, and then we were getting the news. At the time, we didn't have money, like the pocket money weren't given. Imagine, I heard the news, first I had classes. I actually didn't know what to do. That was like the only hope I had.
Chakwana says besides paying for her tuition and accommodation, USAID was giving her money for groceries and the internet connection for her mobile phone. She says she now survives on money she borrows from friends. Jessica Bwira is Malawi's Minister of Higher Education. She says the aid suspension is discouraging, but says the Malawi government is finding other sources to help students.
We've engaged local partnerships, that is the private sector, to see how they can help us. We've also engaged our international partners. For example, we've got a standing agreement with the Republic of Morocco. We've also engaged the Czech Republic, and we'll be engaging others too.
Alexander Kude is the deputy director for the Commonwealth Students Association. He told VOA that the U.S. foreign aid suspension should be a wake-up call for developing countries to start investing more in education and reduce over-dependence in foreign aid.
Look, the budget that United States of America use or funds us on this USAID is just a percentage of their money and budget. If you look at how much that is and where do they get it from, why not standing alone and doing it ourselves?
The Trump administration says it imposed the 90-day freeze to review USAID spending and make sure that it aligns with U.S. policy and interests. The freeze will extend through April 20th. Lamek Masina, VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Russia and Sudan sign an agreement. Find out more after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Sudanese Foreign Minister Ali Youssef Sharif said Wednesday that an agreement has been reached to allow Russia to build a naval base in the country. Sharif spoke following talks in Moscow with Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. Reuters News reports that Sharif said, quote, "We are in complete agreement on the issue and there are no obstacles," end quote. The Sudanese diplomat did not provide details on the plan, which has been discussed for years since a deal was signed under former President Omar al-Bashir. The army generals who overthrew him in 2019 said later the plan was under review and a base never materialized. Russia has cultivated ties with both sides in Sudan's almost two-year-old civil war, and Russian officials have visited the army's wartime capital of Port Sudan in recent months. Last year, a top Sudanese general said Russia asked for a fueling station on the Red Sea in exchange for weapons and ammunition. After a successful prisoner swap with Russia, U.S. President Donald Trump launched a multi-front diplomatic blitz Wednesday to end the Ukraine conflict, saying he would meet with Russia's leaders soon and dispatching a vice president-led team to meet with Ukraine's leader on Friday. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell catches up on the latest from Washington.
President Donald Trump laid down his conditions for continued U.S. support for Ukraine as he set in motion a diplomatic charge aimed at ending Russia's nearly three-year invasion of the embattled country.
So we're getting security on our money. We're going to have it secured by, they have rare earth and they have oil and gas and they have a lot of other things. And we're asking for security on our money.
So does it mean you're not sending anymore?
They've agreed to it. Ukraine has agreed to it.
You are not sending any more aid to Ukraine.
No, we are, but we want it secured, and the money is going to be secured.
U.S. lawmakers have approved nearly $183 billion for military and non-military support for Ukraine since February 2022, according to a new oversight report delivered to Congress on Wednesday. Just under $40 billion remains available. Trump's comments cap a whirlwind day of diplomacy, including calls between Trump and his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky confirmed he and Trump had a long conversation. In a meeting Wednesday with the new U.S. Treasury Secretary over a potential economic deal, Zelensky stressed Ukraine's main demand in its peace plan, NATO membership for Ukraine, and its need for security guarantees.
And I ask President Trump to give us these security guarantees to help Ukraine, to strengthen us. Of course, we have to talk to Europe because we have to have an even bigger army. We have a budget deficit now, but to have an even bigger army, at least as big as it is now, and to feed an army is to have a big resource. This money has to come from somewhere. These are roughly the security guarantees.
Trump also said he would meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Saudi Arabia in the not-too-distant future. He expressed hope that Moscow's decision to swap American teacher Mark Fogel for a Russian cybercrime kingpin would lay a good path for negotiations to end the war. The Kremlin, speaking of the prisoner swap, said this. Dmitry Peskov is spokesman for the Russian presidency.
Naturally, such agreements are preceded by very, very meticulous negotiations. And of course, such agreements are unlikely to be able to become a turning point. But at the same time, bit by bit, these are certain steps to build up that very mutual trust, which is now at its lowest point.
Vice President J.D. Vance now heads from France to Germany, where he will head high-level U.S. talks with Zelensky on Friday in Munich as part of his first foreign trip in the role. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
The international community is celebrating World Radio Day today on Thursday with the theme Radio and Climate Change. Journalists say the medium has evolved over time and that the majority are embracing the digital world to educate the audience on current affairs. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Today being World Radio Day, many journalists are using the platform to educate people on matters affecting the globe. As the world faces the growing challenges of climate change, radio remains a vital medium for spreading awareness, educating audiences, and encouraging collective action. Hassan Ali is a seasonal journalist in Kenya working for Radio 47. He hosts a Swahili show on Saturdays to educate and enlighten listeners in Swahili about the language and other issues.
Now you realize that this program not only educates, entertains, but it also focuses on current affairs. So I felt I'm a journalist. I've trained as a journalist. I'm also a teacher. You know, I've trained as a teacher, but I don't practice teaching. I practice journalism. So I asked myself, how do I counter that void that is left for me being a journalist and not a teacher? That's why I decided to come up with educative programs that are very, very popular.
Radio helps with the dissemination of fact-based information, listeners' voices, and dedicated radio shows. Ali says today's broadcasters have embraced social media platforms to capture the majority of the audience, which he says are embracing digital media. He says the audience that mostly tune to radio via frequency FMs have declined, and many are embracing social media platforms.
But the way radio is right now is not the way radio was 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. I'm talking about the infrastructure. But them days, presenters or even disco jockeys used to work with record players or reel-to-reel tapes. Nowadays, things have changed. We did embrace technology. I'm talking about the computer world. The masses have moved on to the socials, the digitals. That's why a good number of my programs are not just recorded for audio, but I do record or present my live shows, having in mind that this is an era of social platforms.
The UN encourages radio stations to strengthen their editorial, financial, and networking potential through collaboration and content exchange. Masitaira Morengo is a journalist with Milele FM, a radio station in Kenya. She hosts a mid-morning show that educates the audience on matters health. She says the largest audience for most of her shows in rural areas.
I started doing much more research on mental health and all that. And most of the stories that I do is matters mental health. However, I'm always open to broader health because I realized mental health, yes, it's broad, but people actually would also want to know much about other things that actually are happening in our society today. So what I would say as we celebrate World Radio Day, let us give health an upper hand when reporting.
According to UNESCO, radio is one of the most dependable and widely utilized form of media in the world. The medium helps it reach its international objectives by supporting populations through climate disasters such as tropical storms and floods. For VOA Africa, I am Moreno Jumbo in Nairobi.
That's all we prepared for you this Wednesday, February 13, 2015. But before we go to our music for today, I must tell you I love radio. I've been in this industry for more than 25 years, doing what I can do, passing information to people. We'll now leave you with Abie Jasban and the song Samira. have been listening to Abiy Just Van and the song Samira. And just like I told you, radio can make you dance, can make you laugh, and can give you information. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 5, Studio 1 here in Washington. For more information on our program, log on to www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Rob McLean, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to be with us tomorrow because radio is here to stay.